Men, if you've lost your hair, it doesn't mean you can't find it again. Try Hims Hair Loss Solutions and you'll be joining hundreds of thousands of subscribers who found their hair again. It can be hard for men to deal with hair loss, even though it is common. Luckily, I'm here to provide you with a solution so you don't even have to talk about it. Through Hims, you can restore your hair by accessing their personalized hair loss solutions. Men value many different things about their appearance. But if you're a guy who really cares about your hair and find that it's slowly going away, you might be feeling discouraged when you look in the mirror. And that's where Hims comes in. Check out their personalized hair loss solutions, and you can start seeing your hair grow back in as little as 3 to 6 months. Hims provides you with convenient access to a range of hair loss treatments that work, all from the comfort of your couch. Hims makes treating hair loss simple with doctor-trusted options and clinically proven ingredients, like finasteride and minoxidil that can regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. Choose from personalized chewable, oral, spray, and serum treatments to find what works best for you. The process is simple and 100% online, so there are no uncomfortable doctor visits. Answer a few questions, and a medical provider will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your treatment is sent directly to you for free. No insurance is needed, and one low price covers everything from treatments to ongoing care. Hims has hundreds of thousands of trusted subscribers, and they can help you get your confidence back too with visibly thicker and fuller hair. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your personalized hair loss treatment options. hims.com/Hail Mary. Results may vary, based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription products require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're here for part two of the discussion of the offense from that fabulous win over Cincinnati. Great comeback win. Jonas Schaefer again here joining us. Jonas, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Ken.
Pretty much the same as when I asked you an hour and a half ago, I'm sure. We had a very long first episode, tons of content in there, a lot of discussion back and forth about simulated pressure on Lamar, how that worked out, the number of times he was blitzed and the Cincinnati going on. Some great points by Jonas about Justice Hill's blocking in terms of what it could have meant in the AFC Championship. He had a low grade in this game, but honestly, I thought blocked pretty well as a pass blocker, particularly. Some of the ways in which they used Derrick Henry, we kind of hit on. We hit on a lot of the Davante Adams talk and some of the other turmoil going on with other teams in the AFC and the NFL in general, but particularly what's going on with the New York Jets right now and the firing of Saleh today. Just a lot of it going on in the football world. We're at the confluence of NFL history here. And really appreciating our time talking football. And as always, Jonas, any conversation with you is a conversation worth having.
Likewise, Ken. Appreciate it, man.
Let's move on and talk about some Ravens scheme and results in here. Just talk about the running back snap division a little bit. Hill 41, Henry 39. First of all, there are people who are going to see that and say, why would you have Justice Hill on the field more than you'd have Derrick Henry on the field? Well, there's lots of good reasons. And one of them is that Derrick Henry, you know, most of the time gets the ball when he's on the field and Justice Hill doesn't. And so you have a lot of passing situations where you'd want to use Hill instead. They used two snaps of Pony, I thought was the most interesting thing for the first time this year. They hadn't done any of that and were still at zero total snaps for running back three. And they're now out of elevations on their RB3s that they still have on the roster.
Remember 6 weeks ago when, I don't listen to the sports talk radio, but remember when that was, I'm sure a topic that was filling segments on sports talk radio, just like, who's going to be the Ravens running back three? And I was like, well, actually, if you looked at Derrick Henry's workload in Tennessee last year, it was pretty much an equal split with Tyjae Spears. And there was like no other running back who got a touch to speak of. And lo and behold, that's exactly what's played out here in Baltimore. I'm glad that you pointed out, Ken, we saw the pony personnel, because it obviously leads your mind to wonder whether, you know, that could be Keith Mitchell taking the role of Justice Hill as the more home run thready type guy. Obviously, we don't know exactly what he's going to be physically in that first year coming back from the ACL. I think it was a pretty nice fit last year when it was Gus Edwards and Keith Mitchell on the field together, because Gus had no, you know, reservations whatsoever about turning into that lead blocker, whether it's for Lamar or for Keaton. Obviously, Derrick Henry is like an ultimate team first kind of humble guy, but I don't know if he's ever been asked to have that kind of role. So I don't know if he would have any kind of reservations about being the lead blocker for this guy who he's never seen run in person. But it was cool to see the way that they use Pony with the option. I guess the simple read option on the first one, and then the kind of triple option on that second one that Lamar ended up keeping for himself.
You know, going back to the part about Henry blocking and being unselfish, he certainly does it fairly effectively on pass plays. He's asked to block on pass plays a fair amount and does a very good job. He's one of the best running backs in the entire league at doing it, which you'd expect out of a 248-pound guy or whatever he is now. But anyway, he'll get the ball 7 out of his 41 snaps. Henry's 16 out of his 39, so he's getting the ball over 40% of the time. This is actually one of his lower games in terms of percentage of touches where he actually percentage of snaps where he actually got a touch. So you really are you see a big difference in that way. One of the things about this game was we went with lighter packages than that he'd be going with the last couple of weeks. We've talked about on this show a lot, Jonas, that the inability to really get 12 personnel on the field in the way that Ravens fans want to think about it as being likely an Andrews on the field at the same time, both as receiving threats. The Ravens have kind of been a team that's gone to one inline tight end and one standing tight end, which leads to a lot of Kohler and somebody else, less of Andrews and Likely together. And even when it's Andrews and Likely on the field, usually one of them is a traditional tight end kind of stance, meaning not feet separated like a wide receiver, which is the distinction we make when we're charting, you know, how these people line up, that they are more as tight ends, or one guy at least is more as a tight end and in line. 1.87 heavies per play, down from 2.15 against Buffalo, where obviously they were really trying to close the game out for a fair portion of that game with Derrick Henry.
Yeah, according to True Media, it looks like 66 snaps so far this season with Mark and Isaiah on the field together. So it's about
13 per game.
Yeah. Again, it's been effective. 0.22 EPA per dropback, which is again very, very good. But it was interesting. I think it was also around there for EP per play. I don't have that set handy, but it was interesting to me when I was kind of playing around with the splits that Isaiah and Kohler were a more efficient duo than Mark and Isaiah. And again, you're kind of splitting hairs there because small sample size, because it's still a really, really effective thing. But I think not just EPA wise that the Likely Kohler pairing was better, but it was also, it had a marginally higher success rate, which was also interesting that it wasn't just swayed by a couple, you know, deep shots or, you know, nice catch and runs or whatever that kind of juiced that stat, but that there was some real sustainability to it. And obviously that kind of makes the whole notion of, you know, Mark and Isaiah and how tenable is it to have them be on the field together in an interesting proposition. But, you know, it's still early in the season, and I'm sure we're all, you know, the Monken and, you know, the George Kotze and everyone on that staff are trying to figure out ways that they can have two very, very exciting, skilled guys on the field together at the same time and have be a nuisance for defenses, not just in the pass game, but in the run game as well.
I completely agree on both, and we've seen great run blocking, I think, from all three tight ends at times. I mean, the amount of forklifting that Isaiah Likely has done in the last few weeks has been very impressive. You know, he's lifting guys off the ground. He's knocking them out of the ballpark. I mean, he's whatever you want to use as an analogy. I think that, you know, part of the value also of having two great receiving tight ends like Likely and Andrews, and I don't want to even exclude Kolar from this game with the game he had, is that keeping them fresh and alternating them on the field has real value as well.
Yeah, that's definitely a consideration. It was interesting to me. This doesn't really have anything to do with freshness, but I wonder if defenses are as surprised as I was to see like Kolar be the first guy or one of like to be the guy who takes the field with the starting offense for as many drives as he did against Cincinnati. It seemed like every time the Ravens were taking the field, it was you know, Likely out there, obviously, but it was Kolar there, you know, sometimes with Ricard, sometimes not. But you know, when you are thinking about how coordinators go about scripting game plans and, you know, having kind of statements of intent, it was pretty interesting to me that, you know, at least for the first, you know, three or four drives or whenever I kind of stopped keeping track of who was out there to start a certain offensive possession, that it was Kolar who was out there with the 11 and it was Mark on the sideline.
Mm-hmm. It's been, Mark is more of a designated receiver now when you get right down to it. It's not that he can't block. He's just, that's more of his job this year. I think that the last three games in particular, the Ravens have come into the game with a very good group of scripted plays. It probably is true of the Raiders game too. I have to go back and think about it, but they've gone in, they've probed at the opponent. They've done a good job of trying to figure out what they're going to do. They've had a good variation in terms of their plays. And you know how the practice week goes, but the scripted plays are often the plays the players know best. They're the ones they've been through the dance steps for on Friday. You know, when it pisses off writers to be around sometimes when they have a walkthrough practice, and you guys in the story of the season, you don't really see it, but during camp, we see it sometimes and it's a pain in the ass is that they'll, you know, there's nothing to write about when they're just doing these half based walkthroughs or almost making jokes, but that's, you know, the muscle memory to figure out, you know, where do I have to step and cut and break and whatnot, is all in those little, practice.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned that, Ken, because I was, you know, just kind of trying to do some reading up on the Commanders ahead of Sunday's game. I think it was maybe Luke McCaffrey. It would have had to be a veteran. I think one of the Commanders' offensive players attributed some of their incredibly hot starter offense to the fact that they are having more walkthrough practices than they did last year, which means like that muscle memory is there, that confidence is there, the fact that they've repped these plays already and they know what to do. If the defense does X, defense does Y, you know, it's just kind of very, very small routine, boring stuff like that, that you or I, or, you know, Joe Fan probably doesn't think about more than like 5 seconds a season, but can make the difference between, you know, being a team that averages, you know, 20 points a game and 14 points a game. And it's again, one of the kind of unseen wonders of coaching, just how much attention to detail, when you budget the attention the right way, can really make a difference.
Yeah. That's a great way to put it. I did want to talk briefly about the set blocks and chip blocks in this game, because this was a big deal. Now, obviously, we talked about the simulated pressure, by the way, the first episode. The Bengals had 15 times where they dropped two plus guys from the line of scrimmage. You mentioned the number was like 66%. I think this was halfway through the first half or partway through the first half of plays. They had dropped somebody from the line of scrimmage, and that the high in the league for the year was 49%, was what you said for the Vikings. So when the other team is doing that, you have to set up your skill position players to make more blocks than they might otherwise be. And sometimes that means the running back who lines up in sidecar needs to figure out whether he has to make a block before he goes out. And then also the defender or a defender from level two can watch that and basically force him into a certain action with a green dog blitz. He can come from off the line of scrimmage and force him to stay in if he's being tentative about going out at all. But this is a game where they had 28 set blockers and 13 chip blockers. Remember, they only threw the ball 43 times. That's 41 receivers. It's 0.95 per play of their five eligible receivers were assigned to pass blocking responsibilities. The heaviest commitment of the season by far. It had an overwhelming impact on the game. But the player I think it impacted most was Justice Hill. He had 13 set blocks and 3 chip blocks in this game. And he didn't have the receiving game he had at all last week when, not coincidentally, he had 0 set block assignments and 1 chip block the entire game. So that difference is really makes all the difference in getting somebody like Justice Hill really getting going as a receiver. And there were plays he went out of the pattern here. It's a lot easier when you know you can get to a spot in space, use your vision on the field, and Hill, when not asked to chip block, is just much more effective at getting out there and being a receiver. And he's caught all the balls thrown to him this year. Is another little known fact here. And obviously, there've been a lot of short passes and behind the line of scrimmage and whatnot, but it's still very impressive.
Yeah, the one of the game within the games that I was most curious about was how the Bengals pass rush or lack thereof would shape what the Ravens did offensively. I think like Cole Jackson on Ravens fan on Twitter, obviously good follow, good offensive line analyst, has like kind of sparked my curiosity when he talked about how Todd Monken wants to have these five man protections so we can get five receivers out into routes and have a more dynamic kind of passing game. And there is this nice stat on True Media where you can just like look at on what percentage of actual dropbacks there are five receivers going out into routes. And I was like, all right, well, the Ravens had a very competent pass protecting line last year. Where did they rank in like five man routes? And they were, I think, pretty well below average. So I was like, all right, how are they, what does that mean for this year? And obviously no surprise that considering the kind of pressure that they've faced, considering the early season offensive line struggles, they entered this game, I think like 30th or 31st or right around there, and like the lowest share of passing plays with five receivers out to the routes because of what you just said, because they're having running backs stay in the chip, because they're having tight ends staying to chip, because they're motioning someone over and having them be a set block. But I thought that because of just how ineffective this Bengals pass rush had been all season, like Trey Hendrickson was the only guy that teams have had really to worry about, and the Ravens had Ronnie Stanley to deal with them, that if this was a normal Bengals game plan, the Ravens would finally be able to have a kind of normal distribution of guys going out, five guys going out for routes. But because of what we saw on Sunday, they had just 40% of their passing plays with five receivers going out for routes. And the average for the weekend, just for context, was 62%. So you're talking about a 22% delta between how often teams kind of spread it out with these, five wide looks, not five wide, but five receiver looks versus what the Ravens had to do. And actually it was kind of interesting, Ken, that you said that, this was the highest rate of set and chip blocks, because actually the Ravens had a lower rate of, five route plays in that game against Kansas City. You think about the amount of fear maybe that Todd Monken had about that offensive line being overrun by Herloftis and Chris Jones and, Trent McDuffie coming on stop blitzes and everything. That was like a very cautious game plan, I think, from Todd, and just not wanting to, let those guys, just get cooked mentally. But again, like the Ravens through 5 weeks have like two of the lowest five route rates in the NFL for any game this season because of what Kansas City did in week one. And again, because of what Cincinnati did on Sunday, and just Todd Monken's willingness to say, we're comfortable kind of living this way and just, letting Zay and Bateman and, Mark Andrews, as I work with more space and having that opportunity to win because we have Lamar in the backfield. And, he's going to, if he needs 3.2 seconds average time to throw to, go for 300 plus yards, then we feel comfortable with him doing it that way.
Well, 3.31 this week, so that worked out. I'm a little surprised. I just looked at the score sheet from the Kansas City game as you were going through that. It doesn't look a lot different to me. They never held more than two in this game, but it was a lot of 2-0s in this game, and there were some 1-0s in terms of that's set box and chip box.
I have no clue about like what the mythology is for the yeah. Like I'm not sure if a receiver who stays in and then leaks out is considered one of the five receivers in a pass route, but you know, obviously the methodology for the Ravens is the same as, you know, for the rest of the NFL, and you know it's kind of bizarre to look at the overall season long rates and see the Cowboys first in the league at 76% and now the Ravens last in the league at 48.3%.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on and talk about some offensive line. I have a short synopsis I want to go through, and then we'll kind of quickly go through the players, I think, this out, but I'll turn it over to you in terms of directing traffic on that. The nice thing about the Ravens offensive line playing this game, they only had one penalty, the offensive hold on Falele. They did allow 9.5 pressures in the game, and those are charged to the offensive line. That's how you get to a number like 9.5, because they're sharing some with eligible receivers or free runners in some cases. Two quarterback hits allowed. Only one sack was charged to the offensive line in this game. Certainly not terrible in terms of the pressures given 40 throws. It's probably a little bit higher than I would like, but the nice fact is that the quarterback getting hit only three times and it being the offensive line's fault is kind of nice. The other side of this is they got some other free runners for other times that they got to Jackson. I think, you know, probably the biggest story of the day is how they went about decoding that pressure. And I'd point you back to the first episode rather than us go over this again. But I think that, you know, Jonas pointed out two times in a row in one drive in the fourth quarter, separated by two plays, that there were good throws to Jay Flowers, where Lamar made a move to the line of scrimmage, seemingly to align people for blocking responsibilities when the Bengals had eight at the line of scrimmage and completed both those passes for 12 and 17 yards, or 17 to 12. I forget the order. But, you know, really speaks to the kind of decoding that was going on in this game.
Yeah. Yeah. Really impressive to see some of the blocks that some guys were able to make. I mean, I think, you know, obviously we're going to talk about these guys one by one, but certain plays, certain, you know, got to have it, pass play scenarios where Stanley's getting a 2-for-1 deal, where, you know, Roger Rosengarten's moving off one guy to take off the most dangerous man because he's the yep. inside blitzer and is able to get just enough time and space for Lamar to be able to step into a throw. So, you know, obviously there wasn't a perfect game, especially for Daniel Falele, but I guess just kind of maybe the most pressing question coming out of this game, with, you know, Harbaugh telling us on Monday that he expected Voorhees, I guess apparently the injury that he was dealing with wasn't just like a low ankle sprain, it was a high ankle sprain, and the average turnaround time on one of those is about 3 weeks. So Harbaugh on Monday sounded optimistic that Voorhees would be good to go for Sunday's game. Obviously he was, I think, a full participant in Friday's practice, so that's a good sign for his potential availability. But I mean, I guess it's tough to make these calls in a vacuum, because McCary has had some of the, you know, back concerns where you don't want to overwork him, especially over the course of a long season. But do you stick with him at left guard, with him getting the A-? Do you throw Voorhees back in there because of just the kind of development plan that he's on? I mean, what do you do with McCary having done well, Rosengarten having done well, but Voorhees also now coming back at potentially full strength?
Complex parking lot puzzle to unravel, because there's more things involved. And I'll start with, you know, one of the things that happened in this game is Josh Jones played really reasonably well. And I want to get through that maybe first, and then we can talk about some of this. But Josh Jones played well, and it wasn't a lot of snaps, but he looked really good out there. I mean, really good. And so to me, he looks like a guy who you can maybe trust to be the first tackle, but I'd hate to be fooled by nine snaps, you know, and think that this is the be all end all. On the other hand, McCary, I've been an outspoken proponent that I don't think you have your most reliable backup tackle in there at another position. I think you only need to look back to 2021 and the Tyree Phillips dominoes that set off and ended the Ravens season effectively with Alejandro Villanueva at left tackle. Not that Tyree Phillips would have been a much better option at left tackle, but he would have given them a little more depth on the line to have other choices that season. So I think it is a complex question, and Harbaugh has seemed at times quite committed of worries. And I don't know after two games like this from McCary, if you make a change, or if McCary goes back to right tackle, if McCary like does not play left tackle, let's put it that way. Does he then go back into some rotation with Rosengarten, who's now played fairly well for two straight games? It's a good problem to have. Anytime you have six good linemen instead of five, that's good. If you have seven, that's even better. Hopefully the Ravens are in a position where they, can leave their very valuable sixth man on the bench and still get high productivity out of it.
Well, let's touch on Rosengarten and I guess also by extension, Filele. One thing that you don't have specified here in the notes, who did you, and I wish I blame myself and I blame our Ravens beat crew for not asking this on Monday at a Harbaugh's presser, but who did you ding for the blown assignment that led to the safety for the Bengals?
Okay, let me look at the play here really quickly. There was a question, I remember it. One play drive, 42 fails to block 94 is what I have on the sheet directly. So it was Ricard failing to block Hubbard. I did not have it assigned to an offensive lineman.
To me, I think initially my first instinct was that it was Filele's fault because he blocks down on the one tech or something. But then I think someone pointed out that, Rosengarten and Likely, who is aligned to his right, both take zone steps to handle the outside linebacker who's the seven tech or the nine tech or whatever. And that it looked a little bit iffy that both of them would take the same step to handle one guy. So maybe it was Rosengarten. I don't want to blame Daniel Filele for another hugely significant play if it's not actually his fault, but that was a little bit of a concern. I don't put that on Patrick Ricard because it never should have been, his responsibility in the first place for blocking an unblocked
inside
guy, inside, right? I mean, you should never. I get safeties happening on, run plays that start at the 1 yard line, but the 2 yard line, unconscionable almost that something like that could happen and make it look as easy as it did.
It was a very slow developing play. I didn't like it from that place on the field that, you have a very traditional turnaround from under center, make a handoff. It wasn't a quick developing play by any stretch. And it obviously developed with a big hole in it. I'm going to go back and take another look at the All-22 and see if a scoring change is required on that. I mean, you're right in the sense that it never would traditionally be Ricard's guy to pick up, but there are lots of option plays where they leave a guy unblocked off the edge. And Hubbard was the guy on that end. And I can't remember my exact thoughts in going through it and that how I blamed Ricard for it, but I'll go back and check it again. We got to do individual scoring here because we're falling behind a lot on time again here. All right.
So you had Daniel Filele with a D.
I did have Daniel Filele with a D. Let me do them in order if you don't mind. I'll start with Stanley on the left side.
Sure.
74 plays, 63 blocks. He's a guy who I didn't score as highly as PFF did. And I know the reason why. Five missed blocks, but 4.5 pressures, one quarterback hit. I think they've got him for three hurries or something in the game. I'm extremely protective. Folks who listen to this show know of keeping the cone clear. And he had several times where he let players through the cone once and other times where they were too close to Jackson at the time of the throw, including one where he's directly bumped. I'm sure both of us have pressures on that one, but 51 points as it worked out, a C, and he's kind of at the bottom end of the C range. It doesn't mean that I didn't think it was a very positive game from him in some respects. He had 8 level 2 blocks, made all 3 of his pulls. The mobility we're seeing from Stanley is really terrific. And I'm very glad to hear your reason why he was out of the game, because something that's not going to affect him in future weeks is the throwing up from being punched or hit in the stomach.
Yeah, we touched on that in the first pod, in the first podcast. Just at some point in the second half, I guess it would have had to be fourth quarter, he got hit in the gut and just said he couldn't keep anything down. I never played football myself, Ken. Played lacrosse. That was as contact sporty as I got in my athletic career. I never had a situation where, and I'm sure I was like kicked in the stomach maybe once or twice while playing soccer, but I never had a instinctive reaction to just lose my lunch because I got hit in the stomach. Right. But I guess it is a thing where if you apply enough force to the esophagus that you just have to lose your lunch. It was kind of wild to hear because I didn't even know that was like a physiological phenomenon that could afflict people.
Yeah, I've seen it like in sitcom stuff and whatnot that you see this happen, and I didn't know either. Oh, let's move on. Talk about Patrick McCary. He had a fine game, 76 plays, 66 blocks, missed 10. That's not good. But then I look at it a little closer and I see there's 5 missed blocks at the line of scrimmage that are typically happening on pass plays where he's getting beat, but the ball is out quickly or doesn't happen until it's too late, whatever the case may be. 0.87 is his raw score. He got an adjustment with that, ended up being an A-. He did get run out of a pressure. Also, Stanley did. I didn't mention that. He got run out of a pressure by Lamar, which is, you know, one of the things I look at in terms of reducing the adjustment. Made 3 level 2 blocks, 1 pancake, 3 out of 6 on pulls. Ravens are having a lot of problems, by the way, getting pulls made from left guard. They're probably down at about a 50% rate for the whole year, regardless of who's been there. There's been one holding call, I believe, last week. So might have been eight pulls from McCary last week, and he got 0 net points, including the holding call. So that wasn't good. He had 2 highlights, which led the Ravens in this game. So A-. I thought overall excellent game for McCary. Really brings into question exactly what we were talking about earlier about what do you do at left guard? Do you leave McCary out there another week after a game like this, or do you return him to a 6-man role? Do you move him back to right tackle and share time with Rosengarten? How do you handle it? What would be your choice?
I guess I'm a little bit wary of you know, burning of having McCary burn a little bit too bright. I think you want to have him, you know, fresh and available, not just for the postseason, but to potentially play somewhere else along the line. If God forbid Ronnie Stanley, you know, sprains his ankle, or if Roger Rosengarten tweaks his knee or something,
or Linderbaum,
I don't think that. Pardon me.
Or Linderbaum, if something were to happen to him.
Yeah, or Linderbaum. Although I wonder, you know, just based on how Nick Samak came along, I wonder if they would feel comfortable with him, and maybe if they wanted to keep McCary in the starting lineup at another spot, that'd be interesting. I don't know that, despite how well paid the Commanders front is with, you know, Jonathan Allen, Daron Payne, you know, according to PFF, neither has really been an elite player this year. So I don't know that you're really sweating bullets there at left guard. Not great edge talent there. And if you're worried about, you know, stunts and twists and everything. So obviously every decision about a starter matters, but I don't really know that you have to kind of work yourself into a lather over maybe who's starting this week, because it's not like Aaron Donald or, you know, Cameron Hayward is out there on the other side of the line.
That does definitely help. I guess let's move on and talk about Tyler Linderbaum then. 76 plays, 72 blocks. He had 2 missed. I had him for parts of 3 pressures. I looked at the all 22, which is my order of operations here is to look, originally score the game off the broadcast video, and then go back to the all 22 where on, you know, usually 15 plays that we have some question about, did a run block really get made, or did he get enough of this player to at the line of scrimmage such that his missed level 2 block still counts as a block, that sort of thing. But in this game, one of the pressures on Linderbaum I took off after reviewing the all 22 is not at all close to getting to him, as it was a little confusing because you don't see depth as well with the broadcast video, despite all the other good control you have. But anyway, 0.92 for Linderbaum as his base score. That's a 0.95 after adjustment, an A. Outstanding game, his best of the year. 5 level 2 blocks, 1 pancake, 3 out of 4 on pulls, had a highlight. That is exactly what the Ravens are hoping for from Tyler Linderbaum.
Number 1 in the NFL, I believe, still, according to ESPN's interior pass block win rate rankings. So you're in good company there with your high charting.
All right. Very good. He's had all he hasn't, the worst grade he's had this year, I think, is a C, so, or maybe a C plus, but definitely he's been playing very well. Daniel Faalele was the biggest struggle on the line. 76 plays, 65 blocks. He missed six blocks. He gave up two pressures, and that was one plus two shared pressures. So remember, I give out fractional pressures as part of what I do. And one of my complaints about PFF is the fact that they won't assign fractional pressures. So the manifestation of that, PFF is doing fine. Underneath, they have a good score for that play. They'd score them negatively just the way I would. The problem is that other people quoting PFF stats will say he had zero pressures. Look at that. And he might have had three half pressures or whatever. And that's the real issue, is the misinformation transference. PFF, actually, their score is doing a pretty good job, particularly if you separate pass and run blocking scoring, in mirroring how I would evaluate it as well. But the people who quote those pressures, quarterback hits and sacks, those integer values, which they never give away partials, and they have a bunch of rules that don't make any sense, they drive me up the freaking wall in terms of what's going on. Anyway, getting back to Faalele for a second. So he had three total events in terms of pressures, two of them shared. One quarterback hit, full thing, and he got a third of the sack. I gave the other two-thirds to Rosengarten on that play. An offensive holding call that was costly potentially, but the Ravens ended up not letting it stall the drives. 51 points out of 76 blocks, and with an adjustment that was fairly significant for some things he did in terms of pancakes in this game, got up to a D at 0.73. He would have been a D minus, even he would have been a D no matter what. I mean, frankly, he got a pretty big adjustment. And the reason for the adjustment was five pancake blocks in the game, which I think is a high for any Raven this year. I didn't actually go back and look, but five pancake blocks is really exceptional for one game. And the last three games, we've seen something different each week from Faalele that is a very positive sign. 2 weeks ago, it was a bunch of level two blocks and being very decisive, getting into level two. Well, that's completely stopped the last 2 weeks. He hasn't been able to find a block in level two to save his life. And last week had a really good pass blocking week. And this week didn't have a good pass blocking week, but he was putting people on the ground and finishing them when he had a chance. And if he can put some of these things together, he really could be a player. And I think that's one of the reasons why Harbaugh still seems very sanguine when he's talking about him. He's optimistic about what he's seeing and pulling out the good things and being able to eliminate some of the things that are happening. Do you get the same sense from John?
Yeah. I think most of the questions about the right guard situation have been about the would be contenders as opposed to Daniel. To your point about the pancakes, Kent was, I didn't go back and look at all of his, I think run blocking snaps, but didn't he stumble into one of his pancakes? Like, didn't he lose his feet and still end up just knocking over a dude? I think Ted Wynn from The Athletic tweeted that out yesterday or the day before.
Yeah, very possible. I'll send them to you after if you'd like. He had one on a pole.
I'm sure I can find it and send it to you.
Okay. Four of them were straight up pancakes, and they're not level two and they're not poles, which means that's the guy at the line of scrimmage he's knocking down. And I don't allow, I don't call it a pancake if it's a 2-on-1 pancake. That doesn't count for an individual pancake. So I just disregard it. So this is really impressive that people are trying to get by him and he's putting him on the ground. It's exceptionally a positive sign. It's just, There's so much to work on there with this guy, that you hope that he can put some of these things together. All right, let's move on and talk about Roger Rosengarten at right tackle. He missed some snaps. People probably noticed. You probably heard more about what the injury problem was. Maybe you'd talk about that for a second first.
Yeah, I mean he got hurt. It looked like, I'm not sure if he was stepped on or if the ankle was rolled or whatever. But he got hurt on the play where Lamar has to end with the throwaway on like third and five, or I think it was third and five. He has that incredible, scramble to get away from Miles Murphy, who gets close enough to grab Lamar's towel, but not close enough to actually grab Lamar. He has that kind of like, you know, question mark scramble near the left sideline. And he has Bateman kind of sort of open, but it's not, there's not really a viable throwing lane. So he kind of throws it over his head and the Ravens have to punt. But I think that was the play where watching the all 22, it looked like Roger came up a little bit gimpy, but you know, obviously he didn't miss a whole lot of time. And he seemed totally fine in the locker room afterwards. So I don't think there's any concern there about either the seriousness of it during the game or the chance for it to linger into this week.
Okay. Always good to hear, of course. And it was exactly that next drive that he missed, the next seven plays. Josh Jones was out there at right tackle. He did a fine job, by the way, but Rosengarten came back in the game and played well overall, even giving up 2/3 of a sack. He also gave away three half pressures, so three pressures that he was partially responsible for in this game. 0.75 is his points per play. With an adjustment, he gets up to 0.79, which is a C-plus at tackle. Didn't have much in the way of mobility stats in this game. One block in level two, one pancake, 1 out of 1 on pulls, and his 1 point was a courtesy point as a trailer. So when you're the back man on a two-man pull, oftentimes you won't have a block even presented to you. So if that's the case and you run your track normally, you get a courtesy point on that rather than have a point deducted. So anyway, it's nothing special about certainly what he did as a puller in this game from that perspective. Did not have a highlight in the game. You know, I'm of the opinion if your rookie offensive lineman can be at a C-plus level or a C-level even, that means they're playing at a league average level. That is terrific if you can get that out of your rookie players. And the Ravens have shown, you know, from so many players, from Matt Skura, Ben Powers, Ryan Jensen, their ability to Ryan Wagner, to develop these guys who start off at that level. And that's frankly why I thought Linderbaum's rookie season was exciting. He was getting beat a lot as a pass blocker. That needed to be fixed. And there were some, you know, thoughts from people who weight the thing differently than I do that he had a fantastic year. But I was like, you know, he's had a C-plus year as a center, as a rookie. That is fantastic. You know, there's very few NFL linemen who come into the league at that level.
Yeah. And I think if you want a closer look at some of his one-on-one battles, I believe I retweeted something earlier today from Mike Renner, formerly of PFF, I think now with CBS, you know, it's about a minute long compilation of his one-on-ones. I don't think exclusively from Cincinnati, but the past couple of weeks. And it's very cool to see him just trying stuff. Like, you know, you don't see, I don't think you see a lot of rookie linemen trying the, what's it called? The snatch and trap technique, where you like catch a guy's hands and just use that forward momentum against them to like basically bury them in the ground. And it's like, you know, very, very impressive. I think Adafi got hit with it a couple of times in that game against Buffalo, where he's just like pancaked face forward by the Bills left tackle Deion Dawkins, who's very good. I think Spencer Brown also might have done it once on the other side. But to see him have the confidence to be proactive and not reactive in his pass sets. Obviously that was his reputation coming out of Washington as being a guy who would, you know, be like 99th percentile of his aggressiveness coming out of his pass sets and not being a guy who would just, you know, set at 45 degrees, but who would actually almost run at you if he felt like he could win a rep that way. Obviously I'm sure there are going to be some highs and some lows coming forward where maybe the Ravens are forcing situations where the pass rush is much more intimidating than what Cincinnati has, because Cincinnati, it's pretty much just Trey Hendrickson and bust. And, you know, you combine that with situations where the Ravens don't have like, you know, six true dropback situations like it was in the game against Buffalo. Then
didn't you know it's possible to get THC shipped right to your door? Mood delivers premium 100% federally legal THC directly to you. I'm talking about delicious high potency gummies, top shelf flower, home-baked cookies, vapes, anything you'd find at a dispensary, you can now order online and have it shipped quickly, discreetly, and conveniently right to your door. And every Mood product is made from pesticide-free cannabis grown on America's best small farms at prices that won't destroy your wallet. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code RAVENS. So head to mood.com/ravens, check out their online dispensary, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code RAVENS when you check out to save 20% on your first order.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Access big savings every day, all in the Kroger app.
Get tender Heritage Farm boneless chicken breast for $2.49 a pound. Then find low prices on thousands of items like sparkling ice water, Kroger brand chips, and more, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know, maybe we could see Roger really, really struggle, but you know, baby steps are important, and I think he's definitely taken those baby steps to being a competent offensive lineman in year one, which is no small feat.
No, no small feat at all. I have at 0.73 in total terms of total scoring, and to give you an idea, Daniel Fa'alele played 4 games and 94 total snaps at approximately that level. It's actually 2 points lower, 0.71 at the end of last year, and that was like a big, big thing, even in year two, that maybe there's still hope for this guy at right tackle. And then, of course, the Ravens moved to guard and whatnot. But I think we're not far. I think we will see Rosengarten continue to be the every down player at right tackle. And it wouldn't surprise me if they try and get him some left tackle at some point this year, because they really need to see. They really need to see, and they really need to figure out, is this how do they have to allocate their funds this offseason in terms of addressing left tackle? How do they need to allocate their draft picks in terms of addressing left tackle?
Yeah, that would be an interesting conversation with Ronnie. Very, very, very proud guy. And I think obviously playing like the Ravens' second best lineman, but probably would be the best lineman on like 25 NFL teams right now, just yep, based on what he's put on tape. I mean, no shame in being number two to Tyler Linderbaum, who's probably going to, you know, if this pass protection keeps up, where I think, you know, Lamar has been sacked on what, like 2.5% of his dropbacks or something, I think I saw earlier today, and that this Ravens rushing attack, you know, goes on to rush for God knows how many yards, probably, you know, close to what it did in 2019. And I think at least one of those linemen is going to make, you know, first team all pro, and it's probably going to be Lindy.
Yeah, I would agree. I would expect that the way it'd be. I don't think it's going to be the left guard. I don't think it's being the right guard, but I think Stanley is in competition for at least all pro status. Here's my question for you. You know Ronnie a lot better than I do, and you've talked to him a lot more times. Is there a guy there who would give any sort of a hometown discount that would be meaningful? And what I'd be talking about is really depends on the hardness of the market and whether there's multiple teams involved or not. But whether if he could get 3 years and $45 million on the open market, and he could probably do better, frankly, the way he's played so far. Let's say get three years, $60 million on the open market. Anyway, he'd play for 3 for $52 in Baltimore and cement his place in the Ring of Honor. And obviously it's a lot of soft things. It's a lot of, you know, extra chance to win a Super Bowl, where wherever he might otherwise go, you might not have that same chance, or as good a chance anyway. Do you think there's any potential give from Ronnie on something like that?
I don't know. I mean, so much of this is just, it's not the player making the call, it's the agent, because they want to be able to brag to their next client that they got, you know, 11.5 million APY instead of 10.5. And it's just, you know, a lot of the romance of these decisions, I think, are lost because the agents are the ones calling the shots in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously, if, you know, Lamar tells these guys at Roc Nation, I think, you know, that I want to stay here, then obviously there's only so much leverage that agent could have. I know Ronnie loves it being in Baltimore. I think he, you know, really loves Lamar. I think he, you know, really had a close relationship with Joe D, and I think probably took his passing pretty pretty hard. But I don't know how much animus or whatever you want to say that there is between Ronnie and like, you know, Eric DaCosta because of, you know, what led to the contract restructuring. I'm not sure if that was a something that Ronnie was, you know, totally fine with. Just maybe he was, you know, betting on himself the entire way that, like, all right, I'll go back to market 1 year sooner than I would have otherwise, and I'll, you know, maybe have another year to at the back end of my career to get even more money. It's so tough to say because of how unique the situation is, and, you know, how good Ronnie can be, but how problematic his injury history is, and the fact that the Ravens have this very promising right tackle who, you know, until he got to Washington, played left tackle and even played left tackle at Washington, and only played right tackle at Washington because the quarterback was left-handed. Mm-hmm. So there's so many balls in the air with that, but it would be great to see Ronnie come back. I don't doubt, like, it. I don't think it's a non-zero chance that, you know, we'll wake up and, you know, one November day and, like, the Rappaport's reporting that the Ravens have agreed to a contract extension with Ronnie Stanley. I feel like that's a very Eric DaCosta type of move. I just have no clue how they view him with all the priorities of all the guys that, you know, as we said in the first podcast, they would like to re-sign and keep in-house.
Right. It is one of the incredibly difficult positions to fill. You'd like to be sure when you do it, but you never are, whether you're, even if you're getting a top, a first round left tackle from this year's draft, which had lots of great, just ask the Chargers. You know, they got Joe Alt with the number 5 overall pick, and he's hurt now, right? No.
Yeah,
Damian
Prince might be, or not Damian Prince, the Amarius Mims might be hurt too, right? I mean, I didn't see what the injury report was for Cincinnati coming out of that one. Just one more quick thing on Ronnie. I don't think this is a PFF premium data offering. I think this is like PFF ultimate for the guys who are the NFL teams and, you know, super users who pay big bucks for that kind of thing. But there was a stat from the PFF Ravens Twitter account, which you know, always has useful nuggets about, I think it was maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, about, I guess they have like a signature stat called like anchor rate, which is basically what it sounds like how good are linemen doing in terms of pass protecting against bull rushes. And when the Ravens PFF account tweeted that stat out, Ronnie was the best in the league at you know, defending bull rushes, which I think was hugely significant, because when you think about all the stuff that Ronnie couldn't do last year, it was like, can you guard, you know, Christian Gardecki or whatever, that, you know, kind of random edge rusher for the Arizona Cardinals who did nothing but just try to run Ronnie over, and Ronnie could do nothing about it. So I think that deflection or the strength or whatever you want to call it has returned enough for Ronnie to be, at least at that point, one of the best, you know, tackles in the NFL at defending bull rushes, I think is a very, very encouraging sign for not just this year, but hopefully, you know, for him being a guy who could maybe get back to that perennial Pro Bowl type performer.
Well, that would be absolutely fantastic to see. And I know whoever you are as a Ravens fan, I think a lot of people wish the best for Ronnie Stanley, whether it's here or somewhere else, obviously. But boy, would it be nice to, you know, keep another guy for his whole career, kind of the way that Ed Reed and Ogden and Yanda, you know, great ones. That makes him just an obvious Ring of Honor candidate. Right now, I think he's in some jeopardy if he doesn't play additional time here in Baltimore. I think some of the time missed due to injury will hurt him, and I don't think he's right. Got it for sure, even though he's been here for what, 9 seasons now, right? Parts of 9 seasons?
I think so.
Yeah. So anyway, let's move on. Let's talk about some individual players. I do want to get to the mailbag as well, but I guess we're going to have to keep this kind of short. But is there an individual player that we haven't talked at all about in this episode or in the first one that is really worth talking about in terms of their other contributions?
I mean, I guess we should probably give some shine to Tylan Wallace, who had yep. one heck of an interesting afternoon. I you know, have a soft spot for Tylan. He's just a great guy to talk to in the locker room. Always warm and and Gino with reporters. It was interesting to me. You know, I think that the dumbest thing that you can do is say that like a GM is incompetent based on the like practice squad players that they are ultimately cutting, you know, during the 53 man cut down. Like I think these guys know a little bit more than you about the undrafted wide receiver who caught like seven passes for 80 yards during the preseason. But in that same vein, you don't want to overreact to preseason production, but it was notable to me that Tylan, in the relatively limited playing time he got, I think like finished like top five in the NFL preseason, which I guess I know sounds just totally ridiculous on its face, but he did finish like top five in the NFL preseason in yards per route run, which I think was a very, very positive development. And to see him finally, you know, carry over some of that good momentum into the regular season after just like being perpetually a guy who would only get on the field for special team snaps or the rare offensive snap where he would be like the last conceivable option for Lamar Jackson, to see him, you know, step forward and get a couple nice catches and kind of sort of redeem himself for the bad decision to let that punt drop and, you know, watch it go all the way to the two, which led to the safety. You know, happy to see a guy who works very, very hard and, you know, has had some, you know, tough luck with injuries, not just in the NFL, but in college as well, you know, be a guy who could step forward and claim a nice bit of credit for a huge, huge win on a day that the offense needed every single bit of it.
Yeah. Two big conversions in that fourth quarter. Looked really good doing it. I don't have a lot of tolerance for allowing a fair catch to drop in today's NFL. It's too easy to go and make a fair catch, and it's too big a part of the game. I think the fair catch is overused, and to underutilize it at a time when it really hurts you, wow, that's just it's a bad thing. But in general, Tylan Wallace has provided enough special teams highlights for this Ravens team over the course of his career to get a little forgiveness for one, you know, very bad play that frankly it made a 3-point and not a 2-point difference in the game with a safety. Now Wallace doesn't get charged with the entire safety, but he probably did cost him 2 points in terms of relative field goal position. And because they went for two, it became a 3-point difference instead of a 2-point difference. They wouldn't have done it otherwise, I'm certain. So that really was the difference between the Bengals being down three at the end of regulation and the game, you know, being tied where it was. So it was a little bit of a bummer. I want to talk about Charlie Kolar and his game, because I think he did a lot this game.
Sure.
And has been, he's done some good, really good inline blocking, and he is that guy. He's been split from the formation some, and been effective there as well. I love the fact that he's getting the football some from Lamar, and every single one of these instances, you're seeing trust throws being made. And I think they're good trust throws to Kolar that you can see on the touchdown catch he made, much more so than the long, you know, good yardage plays he made. It was a big time trust throw. It was a three-man rush with eight dropping to cover, and Kolar knew a place to get. It's a two-yard pass. It's not seemingly a big throw, and a lot of people will dismiss it as, you know, big deal, easy two-yard touchdown. It wasn't. I mean, that's a hard throw. It's got to be threaded in there. He's got to trust Kolar. Kolar not only caught the ball like a tight end should or like any receiver should, but then he collapsed over it and pretty much in the fetal position, so no one was going to strip it away from him or take it away from him in any other way. And I just thought it was a really good play sitting down in that particular space and having, you know, understanding of where the other players were around him.
Yeah, and just when you think big picture about the arc of his career, just what a transformation. I could be misremembering, but I think, you know, his PFF snap distributions coming out of Iowa State, he was like 75% in the slot. He was basically a you know, power slot receiver essentially. And the Ravens already have two tight ends masquerading as slot receivers. So they were like, hey, Charlie, can you put on 20 pounds of weight and try to mash dudes as an inline blocker? And I mean, Ken, I think you were probably there for some training camp practices where it did not look viable. I remember like Tavius Robinson forklifting him a couple of times. I remember I think like even more anonymous guys than Tavia is just kind of having their way with this guy who, you know, for the second straight summer didn't look like he knew how to block anyone in a kind of one-on-one setting. So for him to be a, you know, at borderline competent, if not even better than that, guy who can, you know, let Todd Monken do some of the stuff that he did with Darnell Washington, obviously not to the same degree of dominance at Georgia, I think is really important. You know, like, I'm not going to claim myself to be some kind of, you know, scheme wizard or whatever, but from what I understand, like to run, you know, duo effectively, which is, you know, kind of power without a puller, you just have a bunch of double teams up front. Like you need that reliable tight end next to the left tackle or right tackle for it to be feasible. And, you know, you don't really trust Mark Andrews to be that guy. You don't really trust Isaiah Likely to be that guy. Sure, you can have Pat Ricard be that guy, but obviously that, you know, kind of handicaps you in terms of what you're signaling to the defense about what might come. So for Charlie Kolar to step forward and be a guy who is, I think probably exceeding my expectations in a big way this year. Just, you know, credit to him to not being one to sulk and, you know, bitch and moan about how he feels like he should be having the kind of role he did in college, because I think he's taken the role that, like, he's taken the only role in the offense that was available to him. And he's, yep, I think, really stepped into it pretty nicely.
Yeah, been very happy with it. I'd agree. I mean, first, for a player like him, honestly, there is no point in being a complainer. You have to be a certain level of player to start your complaining career. And that's why it ends up being a lot of high productivity wide receivers who are productive in some particular way, and then you move them somewhere else and they're not, after they demand a trade. And Marquise Brown comes to mind as a guy who kind of falls into that category. I mean, the Ravens underutilized him in some significant ways, particularly when Lamar was hurt. But he was a guy also who, you know, he had gotten to a point in terms of production where he was able to complain. He did it the right way, I think, to get out of town. There's other, certainly plenty of other wide receivers, they've done it the wrong way across the NFL. And those are guys, you know, large part, I wouldn't want anyone who acted the way Dez Bryant did in his years after football. Effectively, he was out of football for two full years, wasn't a good player for his last 3 years before that with the Cowboys. And then, you know, felt like he could act like a superstar walking around from NFL clubhouse to clubhouse. And I don't want to see another receiver like that in a Ravens uniform.
I think that's a big reason why they, you know, kept Antonio Brown, you know, at least 6 feet away from at all points during that weird, you know, flirtation process, even though it was one-sided flirting from Antonio Brown when he was trying to sweet talk his way into Baltimore. Not to get too much on a Charlie Kolar tangent, Ken, but did you see some of his quotes from the post-game locker room?
No, I didn't. Tell us about him.
Okay. If you want to read them yourself, they're up on the Ravens transcript site. Notably, the first quote that that he had was not transcribed. I asked him if this game felt like some of the you know, the Big 12 shootouts that he was accustomed to at Iowa State, and he just kind of started rambling about how, like, games at Iowa State were always fun because they would either win a game by 35 points that they were expected to, you know, that they were favored in by seven, or they would have a game that they were favored by 35 points and come down to the wire. After he got talking about his experiences with gambling spreads, he was very careful to point out, not that I bet or anything. Just a goofball guy. There was him talking about how on the first play after their missed field goal in overtime, Big Dog, which is his nickname for Derrick Henry, takes it like, I don't know, 100 yards. I was trying to run after him, but he kept getting faster and farther away from me. And I was thinking in my head, this is how the Bills felt last week. He's so fast, it doesn't really make sense, but I was running hard. And then probably the piece de resistance from his availability that actually got, you know, blurred by the NFL social media aggregators. He was asked how it feels to be more involved in the pass catching on offense, and he said, quote, it's beautiful. They get so focused on Mark and Isaiah, they forget about the fat white guy running up the seam. I was so open. I didn't know what to do. And Lamar threw it. And I got yelled at for not scoring again. So we have to fix that. But I think it was a little chain reaction because I didn't score. So Isaiah could score. Then Mark Andrews paid me a favor and got tackled on the 2-yard line so I could score. It was a beautiful day.
All right. That's good. You know, one of the things about Kohler that's definitely true is he's always trying to be funny. So he's a goofball, but if you look at any time he's been at the podium, he almost always starts the thing off with a one-liner. I'm glad to see his timing with humor has gotten a little better from this, because it seems like he's finishing with the punchline instead of starting the things with it. That's that obviously is very funny stuff. He's a great guy.
I will always remember. It wasn't this training camp, but it was last training camp when 2023, when they were in the early stages of experimenting with him as an inline guy. And like, I knew that he had this great wingspan and size. Like, I think on mock draftable, he's like above the 80th percentile in arm length. And I was like, hey, you know, you have this great size, you know, as they kind of transition you more to a inline guy, like, how do you think that could help? And he was like, you know, I've never been complimented for my arm length. So thanks for that. I was like, first of all, how did, like, in your meetings with probably at least 20 NFL teams, no one bring up this great size that you had? I mean, like, I'm sure at least some of them didn't see him as like a, you know, slot receiver at the next level. I'm sure some of them were at least intrigued by the possibility of putting some meat on him and moving him in line. So that was kind of surprising, but it was also just like a window into his goofiness and how he, you know, doesn't really take himself seriously at all.
Yeah. All right. Well, so let's jump in and do a couple of mailbag questions here. Got a good one from at Lyman's Backpack. That's a great handle there. He says, Derrick Henry has been boom or bust the last two games. Long edge runs on tosses/stretches, short runs up the middle. Is it possible to keep the good and eliminate the bad, or do you have to keep playing like this to be effective? Not complaining, just curious. Start us off.
I don't think it's a blip at this point that Derek's best runs have come to the outside. You think about the Raiders game, you think obviously about Buffalo, and obviously the put away run against the Bengals. I don't know why there hasn't been, I guess there has been a correction at some point with like teams blitzing from the slot to either hem Lamar in or to, you know, to wipe out the possibility of some of those crack tosses. But I don't know, maybe just the fact that like they haven't really been all that effective running inside zone and duo, that there hasn't been a whole lot of daylight for him inside, and they've been able to, you know, use Lamar and his ability to read out option plays to kind of get, you know, Derrick Henry in space. But I don't know. I don't really have a great answer for either why one aspect of the offense is effective and the other isn't, and maybe why teams haven't kind of counterpunched effectively, besides the fact that, you know, the Ravens have kind of, had the personnel advantage definitely the last 3 weeks against some of these smaller, less talented defenses.
Yeah, I have some things to say about this. I'd say that specifically, the Ravens probably bigger run blocking advantages are on the outside as opposed to the inside. They have good run blocking wide receivers. They've gotten good run blocking out of the tight ends. They didn't have the greatest game this game, and Ricard, in fact, didn't have the greatest game. But generally speaking, Ricard will deliver some outstanding blocks for you. Your point earlier about you don't want to use Ricard inside on a run play when he can deliver that one big block for you, either as some sort of trap block like he did on the 87-yard run, or as some block in level two where he can really seal very effectively and has the agility to do it. They've got an unbelievable run blocking. And some of this run after the catch blocking, so it may not count as run blocking if you're looking at PFF or something, from Likely. The last couple of weeks, they've got good run blocking from Andrews. Right. They got good blocking down the field from Flowers. Interior is where they have some problems. You know, McCary and Linderbaum together are not a power duo in terms of you know, getting things started off. And Fotolele could be, but doesn't really use his arms very well. And he's really been, well, he's been good at different things, different weeks. We talked about it, but I think that's part of the reason why the outside runs have worked. Can you stop it? I wouldn't. I would try and show different looks, and I really want the Ravens to do more pistol with Henry. I think it offers more play action opportunities that they can use there, as well as running the ball at the middle. And I still believe that the Lamar Henry mesh point is the most powerful weapon in the NFL right now, bar none. You know, if I'm allowed to define a two player group as a powerful weapon, I don't think there's a more powerful schematic weapon in terms of opening up all sorts of other play types and forcing defenses to do different things.
Yeah. Why don't you go on to the next question, Ken, and I'll look up some of the option stats for those guys.
Okay.
I'm not very curious about just how.
All right. Sounds good. We got Zach Serpa Weinberg. He's always gives us a question. Lamar had 10 scramble runs against Kansas City, but he has only had 8 since. I believe in his first 4-game stretch without scrambling for a first down. Oh, I didn't know that. Feels like he's using checkdowns a little more rather than being in the checkdown receiver himself. A nice evolution in his game, in my opinion. Good comment from Zach. Actually, I had missed out that he had not had a first down scrambling in all that time. I actually want to go back and check that. That's surprising. Now, it doesn't mean he has not had a first down rushing, because he certainly has. He's had some long runs. And I thought he had a 19-yard run last week. Might have been a designed run, but that's a very interesting point you're making. And no doubt about it, that first game, he ran the Ravens out of 7 pressures in that game, and he has not had very many since. He had 2 in this game. He ran them out of he had 1 and 0, I believe, the 2 previous games, and low volume passing efforts, but still I hear what you're saying. I think that's a very, very pertinent comment.
Yeah, I think Bills game, like I mentioned a couple minutes ago, not a lot of true drop back sets where, you know, you're taking out play action, you're taking out screens. So that obviously just admit that shrinks the sample size of plays where he could conceivably scramble. And obviously the Ravens just did a great job of staying ahead of the sticks in that one and not really having to worry too much about, they also just got great blocking on the side, on the edges in that one. Greg Rousseau didn't do anything. Von Miller didn't do anything. So I think Lamar had a very, very safe pocket in this one. I guess, you know, in the same way that we've seen big blitzes used to kind of throw off this offense because they can kind of hem in Lamar, I think probably that has some, you know, I think that explains partly why we didn't see a whole lot of scrambling from Lamar, just when you are throwing guys like Geno Stone or whoever was coming off the other side for Cincinnati, then there's not a whole lot of easy scrambling avenues to find. I guess I would push back on the notion that like Lamar didn't look to scramble at all, that there was the I think like the 13-yard scramble maybe in like the what was it? I can't remember what half it was, but it was the one where he kind of like broke 4 tackles in a 2-second span, kind of like along the and close to the left sideline, or right around midfield.
Yeah,
he could have thrown the check down to Justice Hill. I think Mark Andrews was open. Obviously, they weren't really closely guarded because, like I said, I think it was 2nd and 20. But that was a play where it stuck out to me that Lamar, you know, could have easily taken the check down, but he said, you know, screw this, I'm just gonna do it myself, and had a really nice kind of bold run that got them back into a position where I think on the next play, or maybe the play after that, they were able to turn that what had been a 1st and 20 into a new set of downs. So I think it's a good sign in general for the health of the offense that Lamar's not scrambling. I think that was the biggest surprise to me that last year, that like I don't know if he finished with the highest scramble rate of his career, but for a long, long time, it was the highest scramble rate of his career. And it was kind of crazy that like the NFL MVP is going to go to the guy who's scrambling more often than he ever has. So I think it's a nice sign for just where Lamar feels he is in this offense, that he doesn't feel as compelled to break off. And, you know, that's a reflection on the blocking, on the route designs, on guys getting open. But it's also, you know, just a reminder that he has this great weapon that he hasn't really needed to fire all that often.
All right, let's go to A Bits here, who has another one. He says, with the Ravens outrushing their opponents by significant margins this season, I expect them to be winning the time of possession by a wider margin as well, which is not the case. What do you attribute that to, and how can they turn that to their favor in the future? I'm going to start this one. I don't think it's important to win time of possession. I think it's important to win series success rate, win number of plays, you know, that goes with it, because it's generally speaking, what's going to make defenses tired is the number of consecutive plays they're on the field. Longer time of possessions actually may mean they're getting some rest in between plays because you're running your plays less rapidly. Jonas, you mentioned the no huddle in the first episode being something that was really well-timed to have those 10 fourth quarter no huddle plays that kept that Cincinnati defense tired when they're on the field for a number of times in a row. That obviously is going to hurt time of possession. Passing during those cases is going to hurt time of possession. I don't really worry about it too much. I want to win snap count. And I know that there are people who will tell you a snap count isn't really meaningful as an indicator. What's happening there, that doesn't make any sense at all to me as a football fan, as an analyst. Not in any way does it make sense to me. What's happening is there are counter currents of causality that are losing the importance of that snap count win being valuable to teams. But I guarantee you it is very valuable to defenses to play less snaps than your opponents.
Yeah. This was a popular talking point in 2018 and definitely 2019, when they were just running all over teams and it seemed like every game they would finish with 38 minutes in time of possession and, you know, obviously like just 22 for the opponents. And I think Harbaugh was, I remember Harbaugh answering the question. I don't know if it was during the season or before the season or after the season, but like what I remember, Ken, was him saying that like his analytics department had told him that like among all the kind of common factors that we associate with what goes into a winning formula, with like obviously turnover margin, I think probably being right at the top of the list, time of possession was like sixth or seventh, and which was like very, very far down the list of those contributing factors that go into a winning ball game. So he didn't really sound like, you know, he didn't sound committed to the Ravens winning the time of possession battle, because he didn't clearly think it was that important. Obviously, it reflected that team's success at being able to run the ball and, you know, obviously, you know, force short possessions on defense, because that 2019 defense was pretty dang good. But he didn't really think that there was a whole lot of scientific merit to the notion that, like, if you get X amount of minutes in terms of ball possession, then that would correlate to some extraordinary win percentage.
And if it does anything, it correlates to it. And this is the problem. It's not an element of causality. You know, you've heard the statement, right? Teams run because they win. They don't win because they run. And it's the same thing with time of possession, because it's the same thing you're measuring. It's running towards the end of a football game and extending time of possession because you have the lead. Well, that's not the factor that got you there. It's the factor that finishes the game. It might be the factor that got you, but it's not definitely the factor that got you there.
Yeah, I obviously can't watch as much football broadcast because I'm at the game on Sunday, but it does warm my heart that anecdotally, it seems like there are far few graphics where it's like the Ravens are 20-3 when Derrick Henry gets 24 carries in a game. Like, yeah, those... I can't imagine how much those kind of stats make your skin crawl, but it seems like we finally, as a football consuming public, have wisened up to the notion that those things are, you know, putting the carpet for the horse in a lot of ways.
They're in baseball. I mean, the Orioles are, you know, 20-1 when they hit 3 home runs in a game. Okay, is that good? I have no idea. I seriously do not know if that's a good winning percentage of that. The big one when I was growing up was that the Yankees had an extraordinary quote unquote record that when they went into the ninth inning with the lead. And so what? Everybody does. You know, the worst team in the whole in the league that went into, I think it was the eighth inning actually, they went into the eighth inning with the lead was like 47-5 or something, was the worst record there was in the whole league. So, you know, the fact that the Yankees are 44-2 isn't that much better. Yeah. All right, let's get to one more question.
Yeah, here. I mean, it probably ties. I was just going to say quickly, it probably does tie into the larger I guess, frustration that the fans have had with Harbaugh, and just the fact, you know, that, oh, they've blown so many of these fourth quarter leads. But again, how many of these teams over the past 3 years have led by double digits as many times as the Ravens have in that same time frame?
Right. It made me a little nervous that he would go to that. It's very logical, by the way. It's completely logical that the teams that lead by 10 points a lot are going to be the teams that give up 10 point leads. But right. It also made me a little nervous that he went to that, because I knew that was going to just fuel the Harbaugh haters in a way. I thought this was a game. Harbaugh just made a number of very fine decisions in. This is a week for the Harbaugh haters. Go hide in your hole. That's what I'm going to say. This isn't the time to be saying anything bad about him. When he goes for it on fourth and one, deep in his own end zone, that's a pure analytics play. When he has the timeout ready to go, when the Ravens are about to lose five crucial yards, when he kicks on first down, avoiding exactly the mistake the other team made, you know, by basically eliminating any risk of a bad hold or snap on that field goal. There's so many reasons to be happy with the way John managed this week. It's not a good week to be criticizing Harbaugh.
Absolutely.
All right. We'll go on to one more question from Evan. He says, after the summer, how did the Ravens end up with an offense that is number one in DVOA and a secondary as its main concern? Is it personnel or scheme on defense? By the way, great question. Didn't answer it on defense because the question wasn't in by then. But you know, they do have a remarkable, you know, they've been remarkably successful above and beyond all hopes, I think, on offense. And yet the thing that seemed all summer to be the most rock solid group was the secondary, and the play of Marlon Humphrey. I thought, you know, we hadn't seen enough negative from the safeties who were picking up some picks. Eddie Jackson had won his first or second day of practice with us. Then Marcus Williams, I think, made a few plays, and now that the regular season's come along, those two looking lost has been one of the things that truly hurt the Ravens.
Yeah. I mean, not a perfect analogy, but I kind of keep coming back to this idea of like Zach Orr being the new front man of this rock band who's trying to sing all the, you know, power ballad staples, and just, it doesn't quite sound the same. And you know that at some point, you know, it's going to kind of, he's going to be able to hit the right notes, and everything is going to sync up with the bass player and the drums and, you know, backup vocals and everything. But it has the feel of someone trying to step into some very big shoes and knowing the notes to play, knowing the lyrics, but not quite knowing how to fully execute it. I mean, like it was notable to me that I think the first and last Joe Burrow touchdowns against the Ravens on Sunday were, you know, bluff blitzes where on the first one you have, Roquan, you know, I think mugging up the A-gap, he bails as soon as the ball snapped, and Joe Burrow just whizzes a pass right by him to, was it Chase or Higgins, just kind of running that inbreaker in between him and Marlon. You know, not a whole lot you can do. It was a great throw, great route, but, you know, how often did you see a, you know, simulated pressure, a creeper, a mugged up A-gap look with Roquan fail last year? It felt like you could count on one hand the number of times that Mike McDonald had that play called in a high leverage situation and the Ravens just fall flat on their face. And then you fast forward to the fourth quarter, you know, it's what, third and five at the, in the low red zone for Cincinnati. And this time it's not Roquan who's, you know, kind of dropping, it's friggin' Nnamdi Madubuike. And he, you know, again, very, very bold decision. You know, if it had paid off, we would all be singing Zach Orr's phrases or Zach Orr's praises for being bold enough to have, you know, your three tech dropping into the kind of hook zone area so that someone else could come unblocked off the end and, you know, turn a potential touchdown into a field goal or maybe even a strip sack. But no, it's, you know, Joe recognizing that it's Madubuike in coverage, seeing T. Higgins run that inbreaker, and again, just like buzzing a pass right by his helmet for what looked like a very, very routine touchdown. And I don't want to say that was the right call, because that's just me playing Monday morning quarterback. But it did feel like, you know, these are the kind of things that Mike McDonald would do, so I should try them. And it ultimately failed in the worst way possible.
Right. You definitely got to pick your spots and your opposing quarterbacks. And Burrow is a guy, you handle all that deception, all those blitzes, all the numbers at your own peril, because he can definitely take advantage of it. And by the way, on that play, Matabike and Washington, Broderick Washington, both dropped a coverage. So it's a really remarkable kind of a pairing to have in there. Even though it was a compressed field, it still was a good chance to for something to happen. We have to cut it off here. Just an outstanding conversation with you. So appreciate you coming on the show, Jonas. Tell folks where they can find your work and talk to you online.
Yeah, at Twitter/X, Jonas_Schaefer, JonasSchaefer, and just thebaltimorebanner.com for local coverage, sports coverage. Obviously, elections picking up, a bunch of stuff more notable than the NFL season happening right now. But it's going to be a very, very interesting next few weeks with the Commanders coming to town, and then Buccaneers, and then the Browns. I mean, just a very narrative rich, I think, portion of the season that we're just getting into after what was already a very, very interesting opening month and for the Ravens.
Yeah, it will be a lot of fun. Highly recommend Jonas as a follow on Twitter at the very minimum. I mean, by all means, get a Banner subscription, but I think a follow on Twitter is the bare minimum, because there's a lot of very good content coming through his timeline. Other folks out there, if you'd like to be on a film study short, hit me up. DMs are always open on Twitter. I'm always interested in hearing that next cool thing people like to talk about. We had some great run concept notions come up, some different ways to align things. Schematic ones are usually good. Just don't make it something that's so broad that you're changing the whole Ravens offense and the way they run it, because we can't get that in a 20-minute show. So just be cognizant of the fact we're looking for some shorter content. Otherwise, thanks very much for listening. Jonas, thanks for joining me again.
Thank you for having me, Ken.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.